From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. China's first manned spaceflight had 1/6 of the world's population celebrating this week. But the space program created a dilemma that seems to sum up China's struggle with modernity and media. The Chinese government's penchant for secrecy is no secret, and a project involving advanced rocket technology in the People's Liberation Army would seem especially sensitive. At the same time, the government is eager to tout the country's technological advances both to foreigners who might want to pay to launch satellites and to a Chinese public gripped by an enthusiasm for space that might seem quaint to Russians or Americans. This tension between the desire for secrecy and national pride was, of course, reflected in the Chinese media. At the 11th hour, the government decided not to broadcast the liftoff live, but half an hour after the launch, the video was all over state media. And now that the astronaut has landed safely, the country is awash in exultant coverage. Orville Schell is the dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley and has written extensively on Asia. Orville, welcome back to the show.
How are you?
Good. So you'd think this would be something to celebrate, wouldn't you? Why did the Chinese government want to keep a lid on the news?
Well, I think it's important to remember that in 1995, they did have a live feed of a rocket that went up and blew up right on the air. So I think even though they were incredibly excited about this and initially could hardly resist the idea of people all across the country and all around the world watching it live, prudence dictated that they do a delayed tape broadcast instead.
But I'm reminded about what we talked about last spring when the Chinese government was criticized for imposing a media blackout during the early stages of the SARS epidemic. As a result of that blackout, the virus spread further and wider than it needed to. Did China's decision to wait until the launch reflect the same desire on the part of the government to control the government's public image? Or did they learn anything from the SARS experience?
I think they did learn something. But in this case, with the space launch, I think they thought there was really no downside to delaying it and not that much upside to doing it live. They could get almost as much bang for their buck by controlling it. And that's what they did. This is a long-standing tradition in any Leninist society. The media is never spontaneous. No one is ever trusted to go live because they might say something that can't be retrieved.
But there was some awfully uncharacteristic backing and forthing on this media campaign. They had a big splash leading up to and then called the blackout seemingly at the last minute.
There's a word in Chinese called re, and it literally means hot, but it also means a kind of fever that gets generated over some fad or event. And there was truly a real fever building, and it's still going on in China. In fact, on Monday, the People's Daily had an editorial, and they said that this was a symbol of the state's comprehensive national strength. So they kind of got carried away initially, and then they thought better of it.
While the Chinese National Space Administration tried to keep secret its list of candidates for the mission, a newspaper in Hong Kong actually released the identity of the lead contender ahead of the government blackout. Did that paper get into trouble?
Well, no, because Hong Kong has papers that are controlled by the Chinese Communist Party. And they're curious because they operate, of course, within the commercial media marketplace of Hong Kong. But they often have inside information. And, of course, they always have a nice slathering of propaganda. But they sometimes are allowed to break things for the outside world, which the party wants broken, but which they don't actually think Chinese themselves need to know or should know at that exact moment.
But don't you think that that information gets back into China from Hong Kong really fast?
Well, to some degree it does, because the world is all hooked up via the internet and many other modes of communication, but not on a mass basis. And this is the whole secret of the way China controls the media and the internet, that it understands that a very small percentage of people will find ways to get information. And they accept that. But what they manage to control and really want to control is the mass consumption of news. And as long as they can do that, they don't worry that much about minor leaks in the balloon.
So what you're saying is that China knows well how to handle its own population, but it doesn't quite know what to do with the rest of the world, which it increasingly needs.
Well, this is true. They actually have a kind of a two-track system. If you go to a big hotel in China, you can get CNN and Fox News. If you're in a foreign company, you get free access to the internet, and there are many ways that you can get around the firewall. So they do treat outsiders in the outside world in a different way.
We are seeing changes in how China is dealing with the flow of information, though. For instance, we hear that China is going to allow the media in some limited way to cover the proceedings of the Politburo meetings. That's never happened before. Is something going on?
Well, China is always teetering on the edge of a little more political reform. The party, too, is seeking new ways to gain legitimacy because no one elected them. They understand that they're in a new kind of a world where they can't simply be isolated and have their pictures published in the People's Daily and still curry the kind of support that they need to survive as a one-party system.
All right. Orville, thanks a lot.
It's been a pleasure.
Orville Schell is dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley. His most recent book is Mandate of Heaven, which explores how capitalism and popular culture are changing the face of China.
We've reported more than once on this program about the radio giant Clear Channel. We've carped about the company's monopolistic practices, kvetched about how they're homogenizing the radio industry, and complained that they are anti-free speech. One story that captured the attention of the nation's media and Congress was the debacle in Minot, North Dakota, when the town couldn't receive news of a deadly chemical spill in large part because most of their local radio stations were controlled by Clear Channel and all automated. Katie Bachman is a senior editor at Media Week magazine. She says that all this bad press contributes to the image of Clear Channel as an evil media empire, an image she says is unjustified. Clear Channel has recently hired a Washington lobbyist and created a communications department to deal with its image problem. Katie joins me now to discuss these issues. Katie, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Now, two of the big criticisms against Clear Channel on the free speech front surrounded two controversies. First, the Dixie Chicks complaints about President Bush in the lead up to the war in Iraq, which reputedly resulted in a Clear Channel ban of the Dixie Chicks from their airwaves, and the troop support rallies that several Clear Channel stations were involved with in various local markets. In both cases, you say the charges are simply untrue.
They are untrue. Clear Channel did not ban the Dixie Chicks. Some of their stations decided to not play their music for a while. Others continued to play the music, including many, of course, top 40 and contemporary hit radio stations. The pro-troop rallies were the sort of brainchild of Glenn Beck, who was a syndicated radio host. Some Clear Channel stations participated in those rallies, but so did some other stations owned by other groups. And some Clear Channel stations didn't participate in those rallies. So to paint Clear Channel with this broad brush that they've dictated what their station should do and how they should act and what kinds of events they hold is simply not true. It's just turned into urban myth.
Well, of course, the other big criticism of Clear Channel is that news and information gets very short shrift, and at some of its operations, there aren't even live human beings to react to major catastrophic newsworthy events where they are broadcasting.
It's not exactly the way everybody has painted it or described it. One of the things that they've taken a lot of hits for is voice tracking, where you have one personality providing the voiceovers and the discussions in between music for more than one station. And a lot of the accusations have been that this person sits somewhere on a hill somewhere and is providing the personality for a half a dozen stations hundreds of miles away. Well, when the fact of the matter is, those are very regional and local-based, and they tend to be for music stations. The problem in Minot when they had the chemical spill, I don't think you'd have Clear Channel saying, oh, no, that wasn't a problem, that wasn't our fault. I have heard lots of different stories. I'm really not sure precisely what happened. I have heard that there was a problem with the town's emergency system, that they didn't turn a switch, that Clear Channel was on one system, they were on another. I really don't know who's to blame here, But I do know that Clear Channel is in the business of serving their communities and making money, and I'm sure they see that as something that they needed to look into.
Now, if you were to listen to the complaints of the recording industry, you imagine that Clear Channel's headquarters is something like Dr. No's hollowed-out volcano, where sinister forces are at work to restrict the playlists on 1,200 stations from border to border, coast to coast, and to destroy the American way. You've been to the Clear Channel headquarters in San Antonio, Texas. Not quite so sinister?
You know, I tried to find Darth Vader. There's about 14 people in the corporate radio division in San Antonio, and only two fellas that are the programming execs. And those two fellas are busy looking at stations that need marketing help or stations that they're going to flip formats at. There's no master playlist. It just simply doesn't exist. It is a rather ridiculous notion.
But Clear Channel is one of the top three radio holding companies, and they have control over many concert venues. Now, whether or not they're Dr. No, the fact is that Clear Channel does have a considerable grip on the industry and the fortunes of recording artists.
Arguing about music and whether or not new artists get exposure, I don't know that you can blame the radio business. You have to look at the recording industry as well, which is even more consolidated than the radio business. From what I understand, record labels, they're going to promote an artist that they think is more mainstream and has more mass appeal. And then, of course, a company like Clear Channel or Infinity is going to put it on the air.
So what's your take on the intense negative reaction to Clear Channel, up to and including Senator John McCain, a chairman of the Senate Commerce Committee, who suggested that Clear Channel should divest itself of some of its holdings? How has it won this reputation for evil?
I find that very funny about Senator McCain. Didn't he vote for the Telecommunications Act of 96? But in any case, Clear Channel's the biggest. Nobody has ever owned this many radio stations. Even Clear Channel doesn't know how in the world is the best way to run these stations and how best to make a really good business out of it. Clear Channel has not been the best communicator in the world. They are trying to do something about it, but you need to look at the whole radio industry, not just Clear Channel. It's not the same radio business you and I grew up with.
This is not your father's WKRP. Katie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Katie Bachman is a senior editor at Media Week magazine.
Coming up, the Bush administration's image problems in the U.S., Iraq, and India.
This is On the Media from NPR.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Frustrated by the national media's preoccupation with bombings, political turmoil, and failing infrastructure in occupied Iraq, versus what the White House views as the preponderance of good news, the president has begun doing what politicians often do. He is blaming the messenger.
There's a sense that people in America aren't getting the truth. I'm mindful of the filter through which some news travels. And sometimes you just have to go over the heads of the filter and speak directly to the people, and that's what we will continue to do.
The president was as good as his word, spending the past week in search of more porous filters. While avoiding the national media, especially the major networks, he made himself available for a series of interviews with local and regional broadcasters. this because most Americans get most of their information from the local news, and because those outlets are perceived to be less hostile to the White House's message. Joining us now is Washington Post White House correspondent Dana Milbank, who wrote about the president's good news offensive. Dana, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Bob.
So filter seems to be a word we're hearing from the White House quite a bit these days. The media, I guess we've now been promoted or demoted to filtration. What's going on?
The president has used this term before on occasion, but it really forcefully came out a little over a week ago and said that people are not getting the real story in Iraq. And he said it over and over again. It's now become a standard piece of his stump speech. And to actually do something about it, he did quite an innovative thing this week as he brought all the big five regional broadcasters, each of them owned, say, a dozen or two local TV stations, and brought them in for one-on-one individual interviews in the White House. So that was quite an extraordinary thing, since he typically does not give interviews to, say, the Washington Post or the New York Times.
Well, the implication is, in fact, the outright assertion is that what the filters are filtering out is the good news from Iraq, with all of the media's obsessive attention on the bad news, no?
Well, there is an element of truth to that. Now, I think actually the most honest way I've heard it come out of the White House is what the president's communications director, Dan Bartlett, said, and that is with this sort of proliferation of cable news, the internet, all these other outlets, what's happened with the network news and what's happened with newspapers is they've moved more in the direction of analysis. He would say commentary as well. I might quarrel with that. But there's no question that we do more analysis. We do a lot of contextualizing of saying what the bigger picture is here so you can understand a particular day's events in Iraq. But they're looking for a local media who would perhaps not be following the issue on a daily basis, might not have all the information at their disposal, and might accept the official line a bit more freely.
Now, I gather this is not the first time a presidential administration has tried to do an end run around the national media.
No, that's absolutely true. I talked to presidential scholars who traced it back to FDR, to Eisenhower. Certainly Kennedy and Nixon did it quite a bit. Even like if you talk to, say, the people who work for Vice President Gore during the presidential campaign, they extensively used local media, satellite feeds. What they would typically do, though, is bring in wire reporters from the national media to hear what was said. At other times, transcripts of the interviews with the local media have been released publicly to the general press corps, indeed to the public at large. What's very interesting about the president's recent efforts is that they're almost deliberately seeking to cut out the national media by refusing to release a transcript, not letting anybody hear what was going on, whereas every other word the president utters in public is transcribed and available to the public.
Well, how's it going for the president? Do you believe that the regional press that have been favored by his presence before their cameras, are they asking good questions, and are they running those questions on their air?
I was actually very impressed with what I saw and what was reported back to me. They were asking the same tough questions that we were asking, and in fact, they were setting up their reports, if anything, in more of a cynical way than we might have. I think what was going on there was just so naked and so transparent that these regional broadcasters didn't want to feel like they were being played for suckers or fools, so they were going to show that they could, in fact, be tough as well.
If the president's use of the word filter as a code word to mean the, you know, carping, unpatriotic, obsessively negative press, does this foreshadow a political strategy for the election? Is it possible the president is going to run not only against the Democrats, but against the media as well?
The fact of the matter is, if things improve in Iraq, the coverage will improve in Iraq. And if things go very badly in Iraq, the average American is not going to place a lot of faith in his condemnation of the media, because the fact is the body counts, the suicide bombings sort of speak for themselves.
All right, Dana. Well, thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Bob.
Dana Milbank is a White House correspondent for The Washington Post.
This week, Richard Lugar, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, called the Iraq Media Network the most important public diplomacy issue now underway. which is why he wants to block the $100 million slated for its expansion from going to the Pentagon. He believes the development of an Iraqi radio and TV network would fare better in the hands of a civilian agency. He may be right. The Coalition Provisional Authority, or CPA, now running Iraq under the authority of the Defense Department, launched the Iraq Media Network late last spring. Soon after, its news director quit because he felt the network's credibility and his own was being undermined by the CPA. Don North is a former senior TV advisor to the Iraq Media Network. He also quit for health reasons, but he doesn't expect to return to the IMN. Don, welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you, Brooke.
So what were you expecting the IMN to be, and what role did you imagine it would play in the reconstruction of Iraq?
Well, we were all in agreement that a prerequisite for any kind of emerging democracy would be a professional and trusted media. And we thought the best way to set this up would be to form a public broadcasting entity of Iraq, sort of a PBS of Iraq. And that was the plan, and it was a good plan. It was written by various people at the State Department, Defense Department, with the help of many Iraqi expat journalists.
But Ahmed al-Rikabi, the Iraqi news director, quit. And he quit because the plan didn't pan out quite as foreseen.
Right. It seemed to go off the rails after a few months, Brooke. It became a conduit for information from CPA, from Ambassador Bremer. I have no problem with CPA explaining themselves to the Iraqi people. In fact, I'm an advocate for this. It's very necessary, but not to the detriment of a station that was formed for the Iraqis. Credibility with a radio or TV station is a very fragile commodity. And unfortunately, after 2 or 3 months, they had destroyed this credibility that I think we started out with.
Well, how did the credibility get destroyed?
An overburdening of news conferences, interviews, statements, admonitions from CPA that did not go through the filter of Iraqi journalists. We've heard a lot of talk in the recent weeks from this administration explaining to Americans that Iraqi news is being distorted coming through the filter. Well, I have news for them. This filter is called journalism. It's what we do. We prioritize, we edit, we comment, we analyze. And this, the Iraqis were not getting any longer.
How, for instance, did the IMN cover stories of U.S. troop killings and ambushes and violence and unrest among Iraqi civilians?
Well, this was our call to put out on the street 5 or 6 reporters and crews each day to find what was happening with electricity, medical supplies, security problems, and yes, confrontations between Americans and Iraqis demonstrating in the street. Then what happened was that we got orders to continually and constantly be covering news conferences and events arranged by CPA. We had no facilities or camera crews. Reporters left to go out and do the other stories that were probably in the end more important to our Iraqi listeners.
I have a couple of quotes here from the Index on Censorship, which is an international media watchdog group. And here's a quote. Rough but perfectly serviceable Iraqi stations are being swallowed up or chased off the air by IMN, which says it merely wants to reclaim equipment that is legally theirs. Iraqi broadcasters outside the IMN loop are scathing about IMN's own broadcast record, but appear powerless to stop IMN from having its way. They're gobbling up independent stations and forcing them under its umbrella?
Well, all the stations, certainly under Saddam, were under the auspices of the Ministry of Information. And the idea was that IMN would take over these stations and get them up and running, train or retrain the staffs and see that they got new equipment. But what happened was that many of the staff and executives in these stations, let's take Mosul, for instance, which is one of the larger stations, they didn't agree with constant prioritizing of CPA news. So they opted out. And in Mosul, with the help of the 101st Airborne, they did become independent of IMN. And, you know, I can sympathize with this, but it tends to break down a very needed network and cement, if you will, for Iraq at a very crucial time. IMN needs to be an Iraqi network. The people in Mosul, the Kurds, need to be able to hear what Baghdad is saying, and the central authority should be able to hear what the Kurds are saying. And this has broken down.
As you describe the Mosul situation, it's not entirely clear to me. Do you think that there ought to be Iraqi stations that are independent, not under the CPA umbrella, or not?
Oh, yes. Let a 100 varieties of stations, radio, TV blossom. But I think what CPA was supposed to be doing, and that is forming a PBS of Iraq, should be a priority. I grew up as a kid in Western Canada. It was news to me that Canada was a bilingual country. I didn't know any French people, but we had this thing called the CBC, sort of a PBS of Canada. I think probably Canada would have become the 52nd state of the United States had not there been some cement to hold it together like the CBC. And that's what they need in Iraq.
But given what you've seen in Iraq, can the CPA really launch a PBS-style network if its credibility is being impugned, and you say being impugned with good reason?
Well, I'm not optimistic at the moment. I estimated that we had perhaps a window of opportunity of 4 months to establish IMN with some credibility to the Iraqis. It may be too late. No matter what they do, IMN may be saddled with this bad image of being a voice of America, being a voice of CPA, even if they start to improve.
Well, Don, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Don North is an independent TV producer and a former senior TV advisor to the Iraq Media Network.
This month marks the second anniversary of the U.S. attack on Afghanistan, the beginning of the war on terror. But in India, it's also the anniversary of the birth of a comic strip that catapulted President George W. Bush into Indian fame as an idiot superhero. Since then, the cartoon has lampooned the U.S. president every day in the pages of the country's most widely circulated English-language newspaper. It is India's most popular comic, and its popularity has only increased since the war on Iraq, as Miranda Kennedy reports from New Delhi.
In WMN, the comic strip created by Indian journalist Jugsuraya, President George W. Bush undergoes an identity transformation. From the respected world leader mourning the tragic September 11th attacks, he becomes a Rambo-talking, gun-slinging, somewhat intellectually challenged excuse for a superhero who dashes into broom closets.
Seconds later, he emerges as WMN, the Caped Crusader, the Knickered Knacker, the scourge of international terrorism, faster than a hijacked airliner, swifter than a speeding bullet. Shazam, up, up and away.
Jugsuraya, working with an artist named Neelab, created the comic strip 2 years ago. Now WMN appears every day in India's mass circulation centrist newspaper, The Times of India. WMN, with pumped-up biceps under a tight blue bodysuit emblazoned with a red W. WMN, with a red cape flying behind him and a goofy look of existential perplexity on his face. Jugsuraya.
I first thought of WMN as a kind of a Superman-type hero, which would signify the military might and muscle of America. But unfortunately, he has the brain of a George W. Bush. So this makes him sort of doubly dangerous. And the idea was to show that far from being a sort of a super patriot, this man could be a potential danger, not just to his supposed enemies, but also to his friends and to his own country people.
WMN's activities range from the exaggerated to the ridiculous, with an Indian twist. He has regular chats with an ineffective, gluttonous Indian prime minister and is regularly duped by a scheming Pakistani president. But mostly, W-Man flies around mispronouncing the names of the places he has bombed and crashing into world monuments and battling his primary nemesis, the Statue of Liberty.
W-Man is something which is unprecedented. There has never been a comic strip about a current politician in the Indian English language press. Never.
Kamal Chinoy is an international relations professor at Jawaharlal Nehru University in New Delhi.
So actually, it's not just a critique of George W. Bush, it is a critique of American foreign policy. And the fact that it has this response shows that it strikes a sympathetic chord in a very wide spectrum of the population.
W-Man gets hundreds of fan letters a week and a healthy amount of hate mail. The strip's creators continually deny accusations of being anti-American, anti-Hindu, and pro-Muslim. Chandran Mitra, editor of the right-leaning Pioneer newspaper, says the cartoon takes an irresponsibly lighthearted attitude toward major world events like the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq.
And by making fun of President Bush and his alleged lack of intellectual abilities, in a sense, undermined the war against terror. I thought it was not in good taste, and it certainly wasn't helping the cause of the war against terror.
Nevertheless, Mitra admits he reads W-Man every day. Even those who dislike the comic strip agree that it not only reflects, but influences public opinion in India. In the troubled aftermath of the war in Iraq, W-Man's popularity shows the extent to which America dominates the mindscape of the average Indian. Jugsaraya.
I think one of the reasons why W-Man has continued to fly in the Times of India is that India is completely fascinated by America and yet remains very fearful of its size and its power. And I think that's the reason why it works, because the Indian perception of America, both at the political level and at the popular level, is double-edged, like satire.
For On the Media, I'm Miranda Kennedy in New Delhi.
Coming up, idol worship around the world, and a murdered journalist gets the Hollywood treatment.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of non-profit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Rock and roll is generally regarded as an American invention, but it took the British invasion to invigorate it when it was running dry. Likewise, the talent show. From Major Bowie's Amateur Hour on the radio in the 30s and the 40s, to Ted Mack's Amateur Hour on TV in the 50s and 60s, and of course the 80s version Star Search, the talent show has been a homegrown phenomenon. Now the UK has taken our idea and is selling it back to us, only it's bigger and brighter and everywhere. Pop Idol began life in the UK and is currently playing in 21 countries around the world. Our very own version, known as American Idol, has brought us the talented and untalented youth of this great land.
For the land of the free and the home of the brave.
David Lyle is the president of entertainment and drama for Fremantle Media North America, the company that's bringing the Idol franchise to a market near you. He has a theory as to why the show is a worldwide bestseller.
We do lots of shows that travel around the world. And one of the things we've found is, gee shucks, you know what? People are more or less the same everywhere. And we can give them a show that kind of pushes those emotional buttons. Once you've demonstrated that a show can work in really diverse territories, everyone else wants to kind of get on the bandwagon, because the broadcasters figure that this is an almost guaranteed success.
We are a news show, so we obviously don't care about what goes right in the export of this program. We're fascinated, though, with what goes wrong. As you've taken the Idol format around the world, I imagine it's not always smooth. What can go wrong?
Well, we did a pan-Arabic version, which can use contestants from Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, Kuwait, etc. And as that got to the sort of pressure point, there was a small riot in which some members of the audience did resort to bringing out blades. You've got to realize that for many countries that pan-Arabic show went out in, this was the first time the public ever had to cope with something as unusual as voting. So it was a very novel moment for them, the idea of casting a vote, and probably even more novel, that the votes actually were counted correctly and the right person won.
The show in Germany is not called German Idol. Why not?
Idol has many sort of meanings around the world. In Germany, it was a bit tricky, because it harked back to the Führer a little. And hence, in Germany, we're searching for a superstar. I suppose in the words of Basil Fawlty, we didn't want to mention the war.
Has the Simon Cowell part been played successfully in the other markets where Idol is on TV? He is brutally candid in the American version of Idol.
By and large, we have encouraged most markets to find a character who's going to tell it like it is. In South Africa, the judges were telling one of the female contestants that while she had a great voice, if she wanted to be any sort of a pop star, she'd just have to change the way she looked. She'd have to get a new outfit. She burst into tears at this, not because she was insulted, but because it was impossible for her to get a new outfit. She had the one. She was working as a cleaner in South Africa, where the wages are hideously low. Fortunately, the public chipped in then, so it was a happy ending.
Well, I suppose there are two ways to look at the wanton proliferation of the Idol concept around the world. One is that we're all brothers and sisters, and it's a small world after all, and we all have the same interests and desires and fascinations. The other way is that globalization is simply out of control and that we are exporting, cultural imperialists that we are, a kind of homogenous entertainment that ultimately is going to destroy local cultures and make the world a less better place.
Discuss, I feel, should be at the end of that, you know. I hate to say it, because it does sound like I'm going to join in a chorus of Kumbaya, but in fact, it is a small world after all. But each of these shows, while there are things in common from territory to territory, when that star is created, it is the right star for that population, because that population voted for them. Like Belgium, where we've done it. They don't really have their own pop industry. For them to create a singing sensation is almost impossible, because they are just monstered by the large recording companies. So in Belgium, in Holland, and in Scandinavia, we've done it in Norway too. We've allowed the public to create a new pop star. Maybe it isn't as good as creating a new Nobel Peace Prize winner or something. But if we can create a national pop star and make the public happy at the same time, I don't think it's such a bad thing.
Well, David, you're kind to join us. Thanks very much.
Bob, thanks a lot.
David Lyle is president of entertainment and drama of Fremantle Media North America, the folks who have sent the Idol format just about everywhere you can think of. And now for a few of your letters. Dr. James Fitzpatrick wrote in with an objection to our interview with Science Magazine editor-in-chief Donald Kennedy. Kennedy said that the National Cancer Institute changed its website to suggest a potential link between abortion and breast cancer, despite clinical evidence to the contrary. Not so, says Dr. Fitzpatrick. A summary of 27 worldwide studies, he writes, was published in the NCI's own journal in 1994. It concluded that a young woman who aborts her first pregnancy nearly doubles her lifetime risk of developing breast cancer. There is an ongoing misinformation campaign, he concludes, though not by the Bush administration.
Suffice it to say that the alleged breast cancer abortion link is still being hotly debated. Craig Hansen of Cambridge wrote in with this observation about our interview with Scott Donatin on the Vivendi Universal GE merger, quote, Mr. Donatin suggested, and I'm paraphrasing for lack of a transcript, that all the doom and gloom sayers who predicted there would be only 4 or 5 shows to watch by now were wrong. In fact, there is more choice. His proposition can only be seriously considered if you count the entertainment portion of the programming. He is forgetting the other role of the media, which is providing information. And Mr. Hansen points to a recent report on the PBS program Now, which he says illustrates that many markets are actually losing their choices for news sources as a result of these mergers.
Fernando Battaglio of New Haven, Connecticut, wrote to congratulate us on Dan Shore's turn as Clint Eastwood in last week's show, but also to suggest that, quote, Dan keep his daytime job. He does that other job at ATC really well.
But by far the most mail we received this week was from listeners who were delighted that we're now offering our program for download in the MP3 format. Most of them read like this letter from Arkady Sherkansky of Austin, Texas. Thank you, thank you, thank you. This is very cool. I love it. Don't you just love techies, even when they're redundant? They're very concise.
Please send your reactions, brief or verbose, because after all, we do edit, to onthemedia@wnyc.org. And don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. For the aforementioned MP3s, just go to our website at onthemedia.org.
This weekend, the movie Veronica Guerin hit theaters across the country. Cate Blanchett stars as the Irish journalist who, through assiduous reporting and extraordinary courage, tracked down and exposed the drug lords who had turned Dublin into a war zone in the mid-90s. Veronica Guerin's story is the kind Hollywood loves to tell, a tale of how the bravery of the individual can win against the chaos of the criminal underworld.
There's always someone. You get used to them.
No, Ronnie, you get used to cold water, not bullets. This is madness.
You do the same. If you saw those kids on the street, you would do the same.
What if there was people shooting at me? I wouldn't.
Ah, look!
Sadly, Guerin's own story ends in tragedy with her murder in June of 1996. In the aftermath, according to veteran Irish journalist Ed Maloney, it wasn't her reporting, but her death that spurred Ireland to pour more resources into the war on drugs and change its laws to pursue and impound the wealth of criminals. The result was a demonstrable drop in drug crime and many lives saved. Ed Maloney joins me now. Ed, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you, Brooke.
You were a reporter in Ireland during the time when Guerin was reporting. Who are you working for?
Well, I worked for both the Irish Times. I was their Northern Ireland editor for a while, and then I moved over to the Sunday Tribune, again working in the north. So I specialised in northern affairs, and that meant coverage of the war and the Troubles. I worked briefly in Dublin as a security correspondent, as was Veronica.
Did you read her stories when you were there?
Yes, of course.
One writer, David Sharrock of The Guardian, said that they were reminiscent of the 1940s true crime stories in the U.S. He wrote, her specialty was exposing the intimate details of a gallery of crime godfathers whose cover names came from the world of comic books. The General, the Monk, the Coach, the Boxer, the Penguin, even the Tosser.
That's right. She almost made the world of Dublin gangsterism and drug dealing into a soap opera that you would follow every week. But it was a very, very dangerous and deadly soap opera.
What was Guerin's reputation among Ireland's journalists?
Well, there is the reality and there is the myth. The myth has been created since her death. She's been posthumously shrouded in glory, awarded all sorts of prizes, regarded as an almost iconic figure, not just in Ireland, but internationally. At the time, she was, though, quite a controversial figure, criticised on the grounds that her standards maybe weren't as high as they should have been, and that perhaps she took too many of her stories at face value, especially from police and security sources who had their own particular axes to grind.
One criticism that was made by Vincent Brown, an Irish Times columnist, not that long after she died, was that Veronica's big mistake was to try to be a player, to try and solve crimes rather than just report on them and hold institutions to account.
Yeah, I agreed with Vincent at the time that he wrote that article. And Vincent is my former editor and was also her editor. Essentially, what was happening when she was covering the drug scene is that the focus was very much on the criminals, which is, you know, not unfair. And you know, there is room for that type of story. But there was absolutely no analysis of the failures of the police in pursuing these drug dealers, and more particularly the reasons why they had failed to apprehend and put these people away. The drug problem in Ireland had been at least 15 years old by the time that Veronica Guerin was killed. The only people who were fighting against the drug dealers were the IRA, who lived in these areas. And for a while, the drug dealers were actually seen as part of the set of opponents to the IRA that ranged from the state right through.
And that afforded them a measure of protection. And so the police didn't go after them as zealously as they should have.
Absolutely.
But with respect to Veronica's reporting, as many people said in response to Vincent Brown at the time, if indeed the institutions that are supposed to govern and control these things aren't working, shouldn't reporters become players and help coax them into action?
In theory, yes, you could make a very strong argument for that. But in practice, what was happening was that the main reason why journalists like Veronica Guerin and other security correspondents for other Irish newspapers were not critical of the police was because they were getting their information from the police. The police were their sources. And they weren't going to bite the hand that fed them. And that was what was fundamentally wrong here.
I don't want to blow my own trumpet, but they know that Martin Cahill's the general because, you know, what I write in the Sunday Independent.
Great, for your readers. But does it help me put him behind bars, does it?
We're on the same side, Chris. Now, I trained as an accountant, right? If I could have a look at these files, then I could go after those other wankers. Put some pressure on them.
And in a sense, you could say that the police were culpable because my own view at the time was that they were using journalists like Veronica Guerin to do their work for them, that she was exposing these drug gangsters and lords, almost provoking them into hostility, which led to her death. So you could present and assemble a case which says that the police actually killed her as much as the gangsters.
What about her employer? There is a clip in the film where you hear her editor trying to convince her to lay off.
Write about fashion, write about football, write about anything you like, but stop this. You don't have to do it anymore.
I don't see myself covering the catwalks or, you know, doing a gardening column.
You've always wanted to write about politics, Veronica.
Oh, come off it, really. I am writing about politics. Drugs are political.
What if I told you I wouldn't publish your stuff anymore,
Yeah, but you never would tell me that, would you, Angus?
Yes, that's one of the areas where Hollywood takes a great deal of liberty with the facts. The reality at the time was that the Sunday Independent was in vicious competition with Rupert Murdoch's Sunday Times for readers. And the Irish Sunday market is huge. It's very lucrative, but it's also very, very competitive. Veronica Guerin was producing great stories, yet she was pushing herself to the very limits of safety. And as the film portrays, she was shot once and beaten up and harassed in all sorts of other ways. There's absolutely no doubt in my mind that she was exploited and she was used.
as we've ticked off some of Veronica Guerin's shortcomings, she overused the police. She didn't criticize them enough. She was reckless with her own life. She was over-reliant on sometimes unreliable criminal sources. Still, all in all, she effected a great change in Ireland. Would we be better off if in real life there were more reporters like Veronica Guerin?
Yeah, except the problem that we're not talking about real life, we're talking about real death. And I come back to the point that I made. It wasn't her journalism that changed the way that Ireland dealt with its drug problem. It was her death. Scarcely a week or a month goes by without two or three fatalities in shootouts between drug dealers. The drug problem is still there. There are some problems, you know, that journalism and journalists can't solve, and these are societal problems that have to be faced up to. The principal function of a journalist is to ask questions about why the authorities, why the police, in all their facets, aren't dealing with the problem in the way that they should be dealing with it. It's not to run around chasing gangsters and confront them and get beaten up and shot by them.
Okay. Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Ed Maloney is a veteran Irish journalist and author of A Secret History of the IRA.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Katya Rogers, Tony Field, and Megan Ryan, who was married this week. Engineered by Dylan Keefe and Rob Christensen, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Sharon Ball and Dave Goldberg. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program, download an MP3, and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support for On the Media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John D. and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.